everybody out there. This is Sean Moffitt, and we are hosting season number 2, episode number 11 of our Future Proofing Now webcast and podcast. We've got a very interesting topic today, cybersecurity and cyber trust. And we've got 3 expert panelists that are willing to weigh in on some of the biggest observations, particularly in the year 2020, where everything seems to have gone afoul. My prediction was, you know, there was going to be a huge cybersecurity pandemic this year. It turns out we had a different one of a very different nature. So maybe there's some parallels there. I'd like to introduce my fellow host, Andrea Cates. Andrea, how are you faring during this this pandemic?
Well, we are always surprised. Every day there's something new in the headlines. And I live in the United States, and it's been a really crazy time. So for people who are listening live, we never know what the next crisis will be. So I'm pleased that we're talking about cybersecurity and cyber trust today, because it goes across all of the categories of what can go wrong.
And I think it's interesting you mentioned what could go wrong, because my hope is we can reflect a little bit on like how this could be used as a tool for actually improving the futures and actually using it as a wedge for actually businesses to improve their lot versus whatever competitive peers they have. So oftentimes I find like the cybersecurity guys are like, they're like relief pitchers on a bad baseball team, where it's like they're called in at the very last moment to help out versus let's proactively think about how to win this game. And so, as I mentioned, we're going to introduce our 3 illustrious panelists a little bit more formally later, but they come to us from 3 different arenas, and I'll be interested because quite frankly, they probably know a lot more about cybersecurity than me, certainly all the nuts and bolts of it as well. So we will introduce you in short time. Myself, I grabbed a few different headlines just in terms of maybe teeing up our conversation, Andrea. I know, like I said, we actually predicted all of these different pandemics having a possibility. The health-related one was 16th. I think the cyber one we predicted last year was the 6th biggest chance of happening. It seems to have gone in reverse, but any thoughts in terms of kind of avoiding kind of our next black swan or gray swan?
Well, first I'll define the black swan, gray swan, because we really love the notion of course, there's black swans, which are, you know, highly unlikely, but a gray swan is something that we obviously at Future Proofing Next really enjoy the description that these are suggestive analytics. All of the pieces are in play for something to occur, but the ability to know with certainty whether it's going to happen is not really the big worry. The biggest focus for business, as we say, is to be able to respond as we see early signs. So one of the things that we think, as you mentioned, Sean, we're optimists when it comes to being kind of rational optimists in terms of cyber panic, cyber pandemics. So what we would like to do is frame the question, because you and I, Sean, have worked in cybersecurity. So this is actually a topic that we have a lot of expertise in. The ability for practitioners, for corporate leaders, to be thinking the right categories, to be seeing early signs and imagining what they can do proactively to let their companies thrive, is the framing that we would like to have. And as you said, it's not about like putting off alarms, but it's looking at, you know, what are the early signs that things are shifting? What are the ways that technology is enabling new decisions? And since you and I, Sean, have worked globally, there's a lot of differences, because last year, as you know, we worked with in Asia, as well as the US, as well as in Europe and LATAM. And cybersecurity is very different in different parts of the world. So we'll have people who can represent that. And I think that from that perspective, the world's gotten very small, because the trends and the issues are coming from all over. So I would say that, you know, cyber pandemics, frankly, I think it is coming, but I also think that with knowledge like we'll have today, you can do something proactively about it.
Yep. I think I came across another article too, which an interesting parallel. I think, you know, Mike in this article had some parallels to kind of the COVID-19 version of the pandemic, and just knowing where things start, knowing how things can spread laterally, you know, practicing good hygiene. Couple of different kind of comparisons to the pandemic that I found kind of interesting. Maybe we'll get into that in this discussion today. We certainly want to get into what the future of cybersecurity looks like between AI, and IoT and big data and a whole whack load of emerging technologies, they can help, and they also carry probably some incumbent risks as well. So,
and Sean, I'd also like to throw something to you with regards to that, because I know that you're an expert in what's going on today in terms of applicable trends, you know, and the way that we look at today's practitioners. I'm curious about you from a thought leadership perspective, looking across the projects and the industries that we work in. What are some of the things that you think might be off the radar that you think might be coming onto the radar in 2020?
I don't know if they're necessarily on the radar, but I just I find it so interesting that I guess two things from a pandemic standpoint. We've seen how Internet of Things has actually helped in terms of, you know, creating some efficiencies around delivering supplies and getting maybe the human side of it out and the safety side. But with that comes the inherent risk of, well, if somebody can hack into that, I wonder what they might do with that and create some perils to human safety, perhaps. So that's one thing I've been thinking about. And the other thing, I know almost overnight in healthcare, we've seen something go that from 98% of the experience being, this is a real life doctor setting where they might not even have servers that exist anywhere but their office. And now it's turned into a situation where, you know, 90% of healthcare being delivered in most parts of the world is being delivered digitally. So if somebody can get in touch with your emergency health record or kind of any of your data, particularly contact tracing now, what risk maybe is associated with that for bad as opposed to the good, which is trying to detect who's got corona?
So, and I'll piggyback off of that for a conversation we had recently around the technology on top of that. So when things are now on mobile and, you know, your GPS can be tracked anywhere, and that's good in terms of safety, security, but it can also be creepy with regards to surveillance. And so the dark side of the capabilities of the technology, as you and I have talked about, is also this double-edged sword. So we're looking forward to talking about both sides.
Well, I'm good in the prep session with our panelists. They all seem like nice, friendly people. So I think they're wearing the white cowboy hats, not the black ones, but I could always be surprised. My hope is we'll just get into, I've got this, Bob will probably appreciate the US militaristic, kind of as a former naval officer, I think, but I just kind of stole it as a visual, just as a parallel to, you know, how is cybersecurity being used as a tool for advancing businesses as opposed to just defending them? Hopefully we'll get into that discussion. And a bit of a salacious stat from Australia over the last couple of days, 8 out of 10 Australian companies say cybersecurity investments fail. So we've got a group of people on here today that probably can boost that batting average some, and just trying to learn how to do that as well. And then finally, it seems to be every single article I read about cybersecurity is there are a ton more needs out there than there are people to staff them. And so perhaps we'll weigh in on how do we find great people or great technologies to fill the shortage of people that exist in this marketplace. So I'm going to pivot to you, Andrea, and maybe you can introduce our first guest and we can take it away.
I'm very excited to introduce Kane McGladrey. And what we say is he's a cybersecurity strategist with Ascent Solutions. I'd also like to mention that CISSP is a member of IEEE and is the cybersecurity strategist for Ascent Solutions. And we always say this because some of the people listen on podcast. So although we're reading the slide, it's very important for people to know that in your 20-year career, Kane has worked with company leadership at numerous Fortune 500 and Global 1000 companies in developing and implementing effective risk-based policies to reduce cyber threat. Thinkers 360 ranks Kane as the number 3 worldwide thought leader on cybersecurity. We're hoping after today you go up to number 1 or 2 at least. And he's joining us from Bellingham, Washington with your family and increasing number of robots. We were just listening to a fun fact about how you've been vacationing lately. Let's just start with the informal, Kane. Like how have you been vacationing during the pandemic?
And thanks for having me on the show, Andrea. I think the interesting thing that's come out of this pandemic is virtual reality is becoming a real effective travel mechanism for my family and I. Just as things kicked off, we got a VR headset, And we have been wandering the streets of Greece and of France and of other European and Latin American cities. I think Germany actually had a really nice river cruise that we went on without having to get on an airplane, without having to endure the horrors of modern travel, which we're certainly looking forward to going back to at some future date. But for right now, it's definitely been a lifeline to the outside world.
Well, it's interesting to talk to people during this particular time. And of course, our podcast, webcast, Live a Life Beyond the Shelf Today. However, this is important because I think that the context of what's happening in today's world, including the fact that most of it is now virtual, which means that our data is all over the place and our footprint is very much exposed to people, is something different. So I'm interested in a couple of things. One of the things is to start really dark. I think that this is a topic. Someone alluded to cybersecurity and cyber threats as the game of whack-a-mole, that, you know, as soon as you feel you've got it covered, there's another issue popping up, there's another nuance, there's another dimension. Wondering, just in general, what you've observed over your career, and wouldn't mind a little bit of history, in terms of, you know, what it used to be about, and then what you worried about, and then kind of how it's brought us to today.
You know, I think that initially cybersecurity was not really well understood by business. And as it has progressed throughout, I started when it was called information security or InfoSec, dating myself there a smidge, it was perceived as being a technical thing. It was a technical function that was associated with the office of the CIO or maybe just the IT management. It wasn't actually seen as a necessity, and it certainly wasn't under the chief counsel or chief financial or chief risk officer, which is where we're seeing it be aligned today. And I think a lot of that change has been driven by the threat actor economy and their supply chain. And I say that because I will still meet people who say, well, we're going to fix the cyber risk. And I live in Bellingham, Washington, in Washington State, where we have earthquakes. No one says we're going to solve earthquakes. An earthquake is a risk, right? Obviously, you can plan for a risk. You can plan to have a mitigating control for a risk. But you don't say you're going to go solve an earthquake. You don't say you're going to solve a hurricane, right? You have compensating controls, you have strategies. And I think in cybersecurity, there's still this sense that it is a risk, but it is something that you can just one and done it. You can just check the box, you can meet your regulatory control, you can meet your compliance goal, you can meet the legal standard that you need to be held to, and then you can move on. And at some point, that's become untrue. And the reason why is that unlike earthquakes and unlike tornadoes or fires or floods or other things that businesses are familiar with, threat actors are continuing to innovate. So we are working in a world today where people on the blue team, I find I'm wearing a blue shirt comically today, actually, wasn't planned to make the blue team comment, that we are working against an adversary that has an economic advantage and incentive to build high quality solutions and products and to actually sell those throughout a supply chain. And that could be the case of say a pariah nation state like North Korea, where essentially their import is Bitcoin and Monero and their export is malware. Or it could be something like a commercial crew like the Maze ransomware team that has been trading on their high reputation that if you pay the ransom, you actually get your data back, and have been working to form a criminal cartel associated with getting other threat actors who are less prevalent in the industry, in their industry, to join on and to create an additional sense of urgency for those businesses and organizations which have been breached to pay up. And again, that's just economic development on their side, that we are not seeing not a matching level of investment or effort on the part of defenders.
Well, I'll keep going dark and deep, and then I'll get it. I promise we'll end on a high note in terms of proactive things that we can do to feel a little bit better about this. But let's go dark first in terms of ransomware. So I know that it's a continuing problem for organizations, and there was even a new criminal cartel formed last week to auction off stolen data. And this notion of, you know, both the nuclear and the NASA contractors disclosing breaches last week. Once again, don't want to be too dark about this, but this is occurring. So let's talk about, first of all, the situation and bring everyone up to speed on that. And then also let's turn it around in terms of what you think organizations can do to not just be as I said, whack-a-mole, like something happens and you're kind of being in a defensive stance, but what's the right mindset? So let's start with the dark. What happened in terms of the new criminal cartel auctioning off stolen data, nuclear, NASA? You know, this is threatening. Tell us about that.
And it is such an interesting thing, because initially when we saw ransomware come out on the scene, it was like any other malware. It was mass distributed, it was not bespoke, and it was affecting consumers and individual families who might have lost their family photos of their holiday, they might have lost their MP3 collection, they might have been inconvenienced, they might have lost their tax records, right? They could have lost all their data on their personal computer. What we've seen in recent years as ransomware has become ultimately a service of the criminal economy is that threat actors are developing bespoke malware campaigns, which are not, they're individual to the organization which they're targeting. So you can't just run it through your virus scanner and go, oh, look, it's ransomware. The virus scanners just have never seen this stuff before. And they are deploying that through typically human interaction. And that could be something like buying access to a person's credentials. There have been multiple stories where disgruntled employees at organizations feel that, you know, they've been mistreated by management, or they've been denied a raise or a promotion, and so they sell their login. They sell their RDP access, you know, technical terms. And what that does is it allows a threat actor to have the ability to get in and deploy ransomware. And initially they were just encrypting all the stuff, right? And we saw that with NotPetya and Petya and similar events in prior years. Now what they're doing is they're exfiltrating those data. And where that becomes really vexing is now it's, first of all, organizations that are breached by ransomware should, under their regulatory controls, announce that they have been breached. However, if those data were exfiltrated, you end up with supply chain risk associated with that. And the threat actors are just doing this as a way to monetize it, right? Initially, the idea was, well, we will tell the world if you have been breached and you're not paying our ransom to unencrypt your files, we'll just post those files up on the internet. And the current trend, the new hotness, really is to take those and put them in an online marketplace. And it's not like your eBay, unfortunately. It's an illegitimate web marketplace where the threat actor really is able to control the rate of the bidding. And it's also able to control the perceptions of who is bidding on this product that is being offered, which is exfiltrated data. Now, where that really gets troublesome, when you talk about supply chain risk, last week, a contractor that provides services to US Minuteman nuclear silos, and another contractor that also worked with NASA, were breached, their data were exfiltrated, and now they're up for sale. And if you are looking at this from a nation state perspective, it's that buy versus build conversation, right? If you are an operator in China, right, and you want to make your quota for data exfil easy that month, well, you could just buy that. You could buy NASA information as opposed to having to go exfil it yourself. That's not really a thing we want to encourage. Unfortunately, that's a thing that's happening right now. And the compensating controls that we're seeing deployed against this are, they're twofold. In the defense industrial base, we're seeing the push for the CMMC, the Cybersecurity Maturity Model certification, being pushed by Katie Arrington, the CISO of the DoD, doing fantastic work, I've got to say. It's really admirable. And that's really to protect that defense industrial base so that organizations that might not have had a reason to do cybersecurity because it just wasn't their thing, that they actually now have a material incentive because they risk losing business. Just as another example, Visser, sheet metal manufacturing and forming shop out in, I want to say, Colorado, got shelled a couple months back. And they were like, yeah, we're not going to pay the ransom. It's fine. And they had data on their servers from SpaceX and from Lockheed Martin and from Raytheon. And, you know, there were missile plans in that data set that was exfiltrated. So that's what the reason for the CMMC is, to enforce that we're not kidding anymore. We're not going to pull a DFARS. We're going to actually say, hey, look, this is for real. If you don't comply, we are not going to do business with you anymore. You can't play in our sandbox anymore at the DoD level, which I think is great, because the last thing we want to see is for our warfighters to be affected because a dedicated adversary has privileged information that they exfiltrated through a criminal mechanism.
So now I'll jump in to take the dark and turn it a little bit into two things. One is, you know, what practitioners in corporations who are not necessarily technical, right? So the technical background is really important for us to understand thematically what's going on. You know, this notion of being proactive, the notion of which types of data is being protected, how sophisticated people are getting in terms of cyber threat. As you said, it goes from family photos to, you know, to nuclear or defense information pretty quickly. Marketplaces, and I'll call it blackmail, you know, like a sense of threat. But now let's get a little positive and let's get a little practical.
Sure.
So here I am. I'm in charge of P&L, company X in, you know, nation Y. And what are the two questions that I should be thinking about in today's market that maybe weren't even relevant 5 years ago? You know, what are two areas where I can say, oh, you know, let me bring myself up to speed, not become the cybersecurity expert, but become a generalist who's thinking of two questions differently. What might those two questions be?
I'd say that the things that clients I've worked with over the years have struggled with the most are thematically, how do we talk about risk? And where are the data? And that first one is important because if you don't have a common conversation around risk, a person who's working in a factory, who's working the line, might think that something that costs $10 is a risk. And so they're going to say that's a high risk because that's their economic class. That's how they see the world. Somebody who works in a boardroom might say, well, we lost $1 million. That was a low risk, right? That's a potential low risk. Not having that common language of risk associated with cybersecurity makes it very hard for us to have a mature conversation if we can't agree. What are the parameters even around when we say this is a high reputational risk if we've got a different perception of reality? I think that organizations really do need to drive very simple quantifiable risks and that they can ascribe values to and say, when I say this, I mean this, everybody gets it. And then you can move on as opposed to wasting time talking about, you know, which risk is higher. It just makes the whole thing protracted and doesn't drive value. The other thing is because data is so useful these days. Somebody said that data was actually the new oil, and I'd posit that's not true if you've been watching the oil futures market lately. Data just keeps going up in value, it turns out. If you don't know where it is though, you can't apply compensating controls. And that's what the threat actors really want. They don't want your factory. They don't want your office space that you can't be in right now. They don't want, you know, necessarily, they might want to hire part of your workforce, but really what they're after is your data. 9 times out of 10, that intellectual property or the personal information, the personal health information that we're producing, collecting, and processing, that's the most valuable commodity. And if organizations can't empirically say, we know where it is, we need to stop, we need to go find that and apply controls there.
Well, I have one last question and then we'll go on to the other two panelists. One of the things that I think is really impressive is you've done a lot of work in diversity, inclusion, and looking at sort of talent. So this is a positive, right? So if I'm 16 years old and I'm thinking, oh, I'd love to be preparing for the cybersecurity future in terms of a job. What can companies do, first of all, to find and identify the talent? And then from the talent's perspective, you know, what's the sort of killer talent that people need to be attractive in tomorrow or today or tomorrow's cybersecurity market?
You know, I struggle with this one because as a person with unearned privilege, it would be very easy for me to stand here and say, I have the solution. I don't think there's one solution. I think we need a range of solutions. And I like to take a multi-generational view on this because there's both the person who's 16 and there's also the person who's 6. And if you look at it today, global economic mobility is really slowing down. It's very hard if you are in an underprivileged community to get out of that. And it's very hard at the same time to think about, well, what do you want to do for a living, right? If you go into an underprivileged community, what do people want to do? They want to be a hip-hop artist. They want to go and be a police officer. They want to be a nurse. They want to be a doctor, a firefighter. Maybe they want to go serve in the military. And the reason that they're saying that is because that's what they see in their community. And at the same time, organizations globally are struggling with a lack of qualified cybersecurity individuals who want to work in the industry. We have, like I say, it's largely a community of people with a substantial amount of unearned privilege, and we're all coming from similar backgrounds. Threat actors know this. Threat actors can actually prey on that limitation, because if we're all talking the same language, if we all have the same life experiences, and if we all have the same basic idea, it's really easy to game that. It's really easy to fight against that. It's really easy to exploit that. I think that for us to succeed, organizations need to be visible in multiple communities, multiple diverse communities globally, and to attract that talent. And that could be something like one of the favorite public speakers I have, FC, Freaky Clown, that's his handle on the internet, but FC goes to schools and talks about how his job is breaking into banks every day. If you're a kid, whether you're 6 or you're 16 and you've never heard of a cybersecurity job, what an interesting thing to say, because he didn't show up and like show some PowerPoint and go, hey, let's talk about a phishing campaign. No, it grabs the imagination. I think those of us who are in the cybersecurity and InfoSec community who have interesting jobs, we need to go out and be visible in communities, not just like on stage either. We need to just go talk to people. Like if you have an opportunity to volunteer at your kid's school, show up, be the lunchroom monitor, be the cybersecurity lunchroom monitor, sure, go do that. But if we don't have that level of visibility, we risk a long-term reduction in workforce diversity and a long-term thought diversity issue that we're not going to overcome. And the threat actors, they'll take anybody, right? They're running a meritocracy, ultimately. And that's what we pledged that we said we'd do in cybersecurity and to a lesser extent IT, but that's not actually the truth. We need to move towards that common truth.
So I knew that we would end with more things to talk about, but what we'll do is we'll put a pin in this. And at the end, we would love to have a sense of what you hear from Bob and Carol in terms of, you know, news you can use, things that you learned from the group conversation as well. It's been really interesting and set a good balance between the creepy and the cool. And thank you for setting the stage. Back to you, Sean. Let's have Sean and Bob engage. Thank you so much, Kane. That was amazing. Thank you.
It sounds like it'll be the continuing webcast that's a public service for getting people into cybersecurity, Bob. So the torch is being passed to you. Hopefully we'll, over the next 10 or 15 minutes, cover off certain parts that are still kind of interesting for people to get their minds into. It's my distinct pleasure to introduce Bob Gourley. He is the CTO and co-founder of Vuda LLC. He has been a due diligence and cybersecurity expert for a long period of time. And you got your kind of, first start within the Navy and was a previous CTO for, I think it was the Defense Intelligence Agency. I could be wrong.
That's right.
So you intimately understand kind of where all the vulnerabilities perhaps lie. And now you're pivoting to have, I guess, a wider cast of clients and different solutions for different groups of people. Welcome to the webcast. What's your observation so far, Bob?
Well, let me tell you, first of all, it was fantastic listening to Kane. That resonated with all my experience and everything I've seen, but it was just so well put and succinct. I think in those few minutes, you got 20 years worth of experience there in lessons learned. And I just really appreciated that, Kane. It was great. So how can I build on that and say anything that would add to that? It's hard. But I would say this. If you're an executive and you don't have a technical background, you might be wondering, how can I understand all this stuff? It's because it really is a technical world. And one thing I've learned over the past decades of examining cybersecurity and being deeply involved is you might already know the most important thing. If you are an executive, say a board member, a CEO, another C-suite member, most of these guys and gals, these people, they know and study history. Have you noticed that? People read books. They have their favorite movies. They really enjoy a good glimpse at real human history. Now, why do people like history? Because the best history is drama. It's opposing forces who both sides want something badly, and they continuously fight until they get to what they want. those old lessons from history we're seeing right now in cyberspace. And I say that's the most important thing to learn, because it underscores that if a bad group really wants something, they're going to keep trying. They will be persistent, and they will eventually surprise you in some way. So to bring it back to history, think of Hannibal, the famous Tunisian leader who was tired of Rome attacking him. He decides he's going to attack Rome. Impossible. He took his entire army, crossed two mountain ranges, the Pyrenees and then the Alps, into Rome itself. This has never been done. When his subordinate generals told him, "We cannot cross the Alps," you know, he had war elephants, war horses, camels. "You cannot cross the Alps." He told the generals, "We will find a way, or we will make a way." That, you see that scene played back again in human history again and again and again. And that is the lesson I would say to the non-technical executive today. There are people in cyberspace who are going to find a way to surprise you. Now, cybersecurity does get very technical. It's just the nature of it. So you need to pick the right leaders who can dive deep into technology and configure it the best way possible and test it and make sure they test it again. Get red teamers to come and beat up from the outside to see how they can get in. But all the technical stuff, you can hire the technical experts to help with. And the non-technical piece that I think the executive leader needs to know is be ready for a surprise.
I'm going to stay within your Hannibal kind of metaphor here, I guess, Bob. And faced with kind of a 2020 reality of cyber threats, you know, certain CEOs may be faced with a Hannibal-like person in their midst going, "Look, we have to invest double as much in cybersecurity." And the CEO will say, "Well, we can't do that. And can you give me a firm belief that we're actually going to beat up the Romans when we get at the end of the cyber trail here?" So, yeah. I did mention that Australian stat earlier, where a lot of investment seems to be maybe falling in the wrong direction. So, I'm getting to the question of, can, regardless of investment, can sites and data and any kind of technological assets be ever secure?
This is one of the hardest questions that remain today. Well, first of all, the way you asked the last one, no, that's not a hard question. That's an easy one. So let me answer that first and then get to this one on return on investment. Can anything be made secure? It's for decades, we have seen people try. And what I would say is you can never, ever prove something is secure. You can only prove it's not secure. You can certainly prove that you've applied best practices. You can prove that you've applied a checklist. You can prove that you have good people exercising good judgment. You can prove that you've done everything you can to protect your most important data. But can you prove it secure? No. There will always be some adversary finding some way to surprise you. And that's why we talk about words like risk and risk mitigation and risk management. Because there really is no such thing as a totally secure system these days. So you need to think through the scenarios. What happens when I'm surprised? How do I respond to that incident? Now, you were also in the buildup into that, talking about return on investment kind of questions. How much do you have to spend to mitigate your key risks? That's a risk in itself. Yeah. What if you're a company where your yearly profit after all your taxes and everything is $1 million, but you need to spend $3 million to protect it? Well, that math doesn't work. It just doesn't. So this is where experience and judgment comes in. You get people like Kane and you say, "What should I do here?" And a lot of times the answer is you appropriately configure stuff, which does not cost money. Use a smart DNS service, for example, that provides DNS firewall configuration. Use two-factor authentication, which, by the way, everybody should do. Every company, every one of us on the call. These things are very inexpensive. So you do a lot of these inexpensive things. Now, you know the adversary can still surprise you, but you've eliminated so many avenues of attack that now you can apply your money in a much more smart, economical way. And so
you know what? It's interesting because I've got a CTO friend of mine who he feels like he's the most unpopular guy in the company because he has to send out these missives every 3 weeks about how people are practicing poor personal cyber hygiene. And I've heard different stats or another, either debunk it for me or confirm it for me. At the end of the day is regardless of the amount of tech savvy that you have and systems that you have, is the basis of cybersecurity really human and the fact that, you know, the frailty of most systems human, or is that kind of a misnomer, Bob?
Well, human nature is important to study. We talked about history. The reason history is so relevant is human nature doesn't change that much. And something about today's humans, I really believe all people are good in their core. Now, some people have been tempted to do something bad or, you know, they're, you know, tempted to be not fitting my description. But when you have a good person who works for you in your company and someone calls with a request, your bias is to help them. And I also think most people have this innate curiosity. So they want to know what's behind that link. So we're dealing with human nature here. And the adversaries know that people are good and they want to help and they're curious and they're creative and they prey on that. They always will. So I believe training is critically important and it needs to be contextualized for the role of the employee. It needs to be fun and gamified. There are companies that do this like Elevate Security. You don't realize you're being trained. It's just fun and it raises your awareness. But still, I believe we technologists need to operate under the assumption that somewhere in the organization today, somebody is clicking on a link they shouldn't be clicking on. And we need to back them up with good technology that helps keep that from destroying the company and, you know, bringing stuff into your enterprise that's going to replicate and go everywhere. But one thing we shouldn't try to do is change human nature. That's just not going to happen.
Well, it's funny, though. Human nature has, I guess, changed a little bit over the last 3 months. It feels like until we're met with the shock of something like a pandemic, we are reticent to change our behaviors. Considering your area and considering just how, you know, cataclysmic it's been in terms of what this pandemic's done for business, what's your new perspective on things from where you sit, Bob?
Well, let me tell you, I personally believe most people who've been in cybersecurity and have had some success at it for the last several years are optimists. Why do I say that? Because we see so much gloom and doom and bad guys just getting so much advantage. And if you're a pessimist, you know, it will just destroy you. So I think like a lot of other people, I tend towards being an optimist in this. And one thing the pandemic has taught me is sometimes we optimists can be naive, including me. And sometimes we just get it flat wrong and the worst thing happens. So you gotta be realistic besides being just an optimist. For example, this is an example.
Sorry, go ahead.
I just want to say my view when this pandemic started was this is horrible and all of humanity is in this together, including the bad guys. We'll see. Maybe they're going to pull back a little bit and take a break. You know what is one of the most foolish thoughts I had? Because they didn't pull back. They ramped up. They're attacking everything, anything where they can get any financial gain. There have been examples of DDoS attacks against organizations that are trying to create a vaccine. So look, there's an organization trying to create a vaccine that helps all of humanity, and they're getting attacked by bad guys. Other bad guys are conducting more traditional fraud, but in ways that like steal medical equipment or ship logistics a different place so they can gain from it. And it's really discouraging. And to me, that says something about the threat that I should have always known, but just underscores the malicious nature of the cyber actors. Just like the human history we were talking about, if a bad guy wants something, they're going to keep attacking. If a group of bad guys want something, they're going to keep getting creative and attack. And the pandemic's proven that. The cyber attackers are bad and malicious, and they're going to keep coming no matter what.
I got a last quickie for you, and then we'll pivot to our third part of the conversation. But I'm sitting on a board, and we actually looked at board talents and skills. There's about 30 different things that boards do. Technology and innovation happens to fall in the bottom third of those two, those types of talents. They're just not brought onto boards for that reason. What's somebody that's brought onto a board, recognizes their role is to be kind of the governance of an institution, and cybersecurity is a big part of that, but they're not at all steeped in your world. What is the one piece of advice you should give them?
Well, I would say the most important role of a board, in my opinion, is making a decision on whether to fire the CEO or hire a new CEO. That is just always, it's a horrible thing to talk about, but it's the most important function of the board. You can extend that to the technology and security team. The most important function of the board would be to understand, is this an individual that you have trust and faith and confidence in? You know, if you have a security officer or if it's in the CIO. So that's an important and very serious role. Is this the right leader? I would also say it's important for boards these days to realize, just like Kane had said, this is not just something for the IT department. Every line of business needs to understand their role in mitigating digital risk. And senior board members and executives can be very helpful in that conversation by asking simple questions of the line of business leaders outside the IT department. You know, what's your responsibility in protecting our business from cyber threats and mitigating digital risk? So I would also say boards should encourage tabletop exercises for themselves and the leadership team to think through scenarios, and should encourage red team testing of the corporate resources from the outside. But those are just some thoughts, Sean.
Well, we're going to reloop at the end together. It's Kane's got a helpful device behind his head here. There's a clock on the wall that says, look, we need to get through all of our agenda today. So really interesting stuff, though. We're going to have the clash of heads toward the end of the discussion, but I'm going to throw it back to Andrea now.
I'd like to welcome Carol Tang. That was incredible. I think that we've got the 1-2 set up for this third leg of the stool. It's very important to understand the framework, to understand what's happening today, to understand the trends. And this is Carol Tang, who's an automotive cybersecurity expert, and we won't be disclosing her company so that she can have anonymity around that. But she has more than 10 years experience in engineering experience in wireless, and previous research has been on cyber physical system and critical infrastructure security. In the past 3 years, she's been doing research in connected vehicle cybersecurity, ranging from embedded system security, software security, to the security of vehicle service in the cloud. And we are also going to disclose that Carol is a client, and we have worked on a top secret project together in the area of cybersecurity, both in the US and in China. And one of the things, first of all, welcome, Carol. We are so excited to hear how practitioners who every day have to make decisions around what to do actually think about in terms of cybersecurity, because with so much at risk, but also so many things to choose from, what is one of the biggest trends that you deal with on a day-to-day basis in automotive that's different from other industries today?
Yeah, so I would say it is the continuous commitment to the safety, right? The nature of the safety in the automotive is at the most, right? So for us, the strong focus on safety is definitely the most important thing in our work. And basically, if there is no security, safety is just very hard to be guaranteed, right? So another thing is with the adaptation to the mobile and to the cloud computing, and also with the vehicle itself get so much connected, the attack surface just increased tremendously. And also moving forward, like I think both of the speakers mentioned that, you know, when we are looking into the future, everything is evolving, and also the attackers are so much persistent with the new technologies, right? Security is so important that it become a feature enabler instead of just an add-on thought of something, yeah.
Well, you were talking about that just in terms of 5 years ago, if we had been talking about the automotive industry, and Sean and I have been working in many industries over the years, if you look at automotive, it's changed so much. You know, you didn't used to worry about a car being the equivalent of a mobile phone with wheels and a steering wheel. you didn't think about autonomous vehicles. They were kind of like flying cars when I was a little kid, you know, something in the future. So what has changed just in terms of the definition of mobility, which of course part and parcel of that in that is future of mobility, autonomous vehicles say, you know, things like delivery services, and then also the mobile and the cloud and the security on top of that. You know, what's changed in the last, I don't know, 3 to 5 years, 1 to 3 years maybe?
Yeah, so I think a lot of mobility service has been enabled, and the digital experience in the vehicle as well has been kind of become possible in the last couple of years. With all this digital services and mobility experience, one thing that rising up is the concerns on the PII information, right? How are we going to protect the PII information when it's at rest or even in transient, right? So I think this is a critical part that even for us, the automotive industry need to take into strong consideration about.
And so since we have an audience that may or may not understand what PII means, describe it a little bit.
Yeah, so it's the personal identifiable information, right? So basically it can be your address, it can be your email, it can be your account information, right? So for example, a vehicle is a very, I would say it's where, you know, the cybersecurity meet the physical security, right? The moment you step into the vehicle, then your physical appearance in the vehicle, that it itself can, you know, your location can be exposed through something if there's a mobility service that can keep monitoring that, right? And the attackers or malicious parties can just be able to track those information, use as civilian purpose or use it as a lot of other different purposes, right? So, and also for the personal identifiable data, those, just as the previous speakers mentioned, that those are of great value, right? People are taking, that's the thing that the hackers are trying to grab at a scale. And if they can grab those information, they can sell it on the dark market for money, right? It's the dark industry now, it has its own supply chains, right? It has its own way of operate, and people are willing to pay for the PII information just as a start part to launch their attacks with different advanced techniques, right?
So. Well, once again, I try really hard not to depress people about this science fiction side of what we know is a very complex and quite frankly, risk-laden industry. But there's also a lot of good thinking that you've brought, I know personally, and the team that we work with brought to the table, understanding some of the depth of what does it mean for people to understand that it's not just, oh, my bank account's been hacked, it's a minor bank account, who am I have $1,000 in it, no big deal, versus, wow, if somebody hacks into this particular automotive database, they could literally follow me home. And that physical threat is very different mm-hmm. from a theoretical threat. So what are the ways that you think about this, once again, without divulging anything proprietary? You know, what are the ways that you think about the positive, allowing the customer to feel a sense of reassurance, and also engaging the customer in this human behavior, as Bob and Kane mentioned, of, you know, yeah, two-factor authentication is just, you know, things like that are not annoyances, they're actually a positive behavior. What are some things you've done on the positive to let the customers feel more secure with mobile and in automotive?
Yeah, I think definitely to kind of instill, help build a stronger cybersecurity image to instill the trust in the product is one like general topic, general theme that we're trying to get to, right? However, what are the concrete steps that we can do to actually strengthen the cybersecurity side to bring in the trust? I would say it lays in the different foundations and the pillars of the product that we are offering. Depends on if it's it's a in-vehicle entertainment system or it's a telematic unit. It really depends on in the different nature of that particular product sit in the vehicle, right? So we'll do different ways to protect the system.
Yeah, well, I think that it's really fascinating that, as I said, 5 years ago, probably even, you wouldn't have thought of in-vehicle entertainment systems, the car as a payment device, autonomous vehicles, you know, some autonomous vehicle goes and picks up your child at preschool without a human in it. You know, what is that like? If that's hacked, it's very different from, oh, my $1,000 bank account. I have loved and appreciated the way that you think about this, because I think the project on, in terms of understanding where trust comes from and how you proactively build trust and tap into trust with the consumer and get them to participate in their own protection. Is there something that you're, once again, that you think has been a really positive mindset as far as, you know, consumer awareness of trusting a brand, trusting a company to therefore reinforce their own safety?
Definitely. So just as Bob mentioned, right, looking at the human history and the human, a lot of the interaction, the nature, I would agree that the nature, the core nature of the human are actually to be good, right? And to do good things to other people as well. So in that, you know, to instill that kind of nature into the product we deliver to help the people bring out the good and to help the people to follow in the best practice, maybe using a bit more entertaining way or the good user experience to help them to understand the risk that they are having and to have the proper settings and configurations or best practices instilled in their way of operated is definitely something that need to be considered.
It's very helpful. We'll go into the round robin where we'll ask Kane first and then Bob and then Carol to each say one thing that you either learned or something you'd like to have as kind of a final word. But I have one last comment I remember that struck me from the project that we've been working on in China, where there was an expression around cybersecurity that it's a race between the devil and the priest. And I don't know if you wanted to talk about that very briefly, because it was a really interesting way that the consumer thought about cybersecurity. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I think it is really interesting that, you know, with different demographic, actually people's thought on the, you know, the good and the bad and their risk tolerance and their trust to, you know, to the system, to government, to platform is so much different, right? It's quite interesting to see that. And security itself is an arm race. Just as Bob and Kim all mentioned that the attacker just gets sophisticated every day. Same time, meanwhile, as the security practitioner, we do need a diverse community to support that and a growing community, the community willing to learn. So one thing really kind of attract me to stay in this community is the willingness to learn. I find that cybersecurity people are like the most educatable and they are fun to be with because you always learn something with them. And, you know, and you can, you know, by no means teach them something as well. It's so fun in this part, right? That's, I think, the beauty of it.
Well, that's great. And we do everybody gets 30 seconds. So Kane, you're 30 seconds.
Andrea, that may flavor some of this. David Kahn had left two questions in our chat box, which I thought were quite interesting. Both were around cooperation. You know, how to... You know, cybersecurity makes it tough to internally cooperate between people because of, I guess, all the passwords and kind of hygiene that you need to practice. And then his question around, is it really true that each company is on their own protecting their critical data and infrastructure? Can there not be enough similarities between enterprise configurations to share the defender successes? So I guess cooperation across companies in terms of stuff as well. So that may or may not inform some of the answers we come back.
I think that's great. Thank you. And thank you to David for the question. So Kane, you have choice. You can respond to question or give advice or respond to other panelists. And you got 30 seconds to do whatever you'd like. So Kane, what are your kind of closing thoughts?
30 seconds is so hard. I want to say that Carol's message around safety and trust is beautiful. I think that's so succinct, and it's a rallying cry that anyone can understand inside of an organization. When they're talking about why are they doing this, I think other organizations really need to find that common goal, that common shared value that we have why it enables our business to be successful, why we're doing this, because otherwise it's just some technical weird thing, shiny widget, who knows why, right? Safety and trust, that's a great message. The other thing I wanted to go just to Bob really quickly, I love what you said about tabletop exercises. And I say that because you stressed that it had to be a whole organization at the board level, not just at a technical level. I think that's something that's omitted. And when we think about a tabletop exercise around incident response, people think, oh, it's just, you know, we're going to talk about a fake hack. No, we need to talk about how an organization is going to message that out to the community that they serve, to their clients, to their vendors, to their suppliers, to their own staff, so that you're able to effectively respond as a whole organization and to practice it. Because honestly, there's no game day players, right? You don't just show up and have a great breach that day. You plan for these things. So again, thank you. Those were really great helpful comments.
And also what we might do with some questions is email them too, if you don't mind. We'll let people respond in case we run out of time. So thanks, Kane. And Bob, you get 30 seconds to either respond to a question, respond to the panel, or say something, word of advice.
Maybe I'll try to do all at once. And I would say, you know, I learned a lot from all you guys. And Carol, something you said really resonated with me. And there's a lot of enjoyable stuff here. You know, this is serious work we do. And there are serious bad guys. And it can be tough. But on the other hand, every single day you can learn something new. It's intellectually stimulating. And if you take the right attitude, it can be fun. I mean, I see Andrea, Kane, Sean, you, Carol, you're all smiling through all of this. And, you know, all of us can come into this field and learn something every single day. And I think if we get that word out, it may attract more and more people to this community. So I just, that really resonated with me. And I would also say that it's more applicable to David's question. We are all in this together. And I've seen a shift over the last 20 years. 20 years ago, it was like, don't tell anybody I've been breached. Today, it's like people are realizing we're all in this together. We need to work even with my competitors. And that's just so important that we collaborate and communicate and find the right information sharing organizations to help us do that.
That's fantastic. Carol, you want to say anything in 30 seconds, either respond or give advice.
Sure, just piggyback on what Bob just mentioned, right? In the industry, for example, in the automotive, we have the automotive ISAC, which is the information sharing community that we tap in to get a lot of threat intelligence there, right? So I think it is, we are all in this together. We have to know that what can be shared and what need to be shared, and we are willing to share with other people as well. So I think to strengthen ourselves as the community, as the cybersecurity community, definitely is very, very powerful. Another thing is I want to get back to Ken's mentioning about, you know, the how you go to the community. That's actually a very interesting thing that I've been recently thinking as well. I noticed there is actually publication for the younger, very young kids, like 6 to 9 years old, talking to them about the cybersecurity. Maybe it's a small stuff about just be a your superhero in the cyber domain, right? So something like that. It is going to the community for them to be aware of the existence and the importance of the cybersecurity, to raise the people thinking on this topic and gradually build up the community.
This is inspiring. I feel like Sean and I, you know, from the future proofing perspective, should just start recruiting right now. Don't you think, Sean?
I'm sure. You know what? I'm thinking, Andrea, I'm sure parents everywhere would love our three panelists to spend an hour with their kids. If for no other reason, they'll be entranced and maybe actually get into a profession that seems to be direly needing people to be like that, from a very diverse spectrum of people.
Well, so I'd like to thank all the panelists and turn it over to Sean to wrap us up. This was really a lot to think about. And it's the most, you know, it's an interesting notion for considering, well, first of all, there are some other questions in our Q&A, which we might get out to you in case you have some thoughts. But then also, we really think that this is the most upbeat way, engaging way of talking about one of the more frightening topics I've experienced in a long time. So Sean, do you want to close us out?
Yeah, I want to throw the panelists links up there, I'm sure. And Bob, I've overstepped my bounds here. I think you're co-founder, not CEO. So I apologize if I'm stepping on eggshells there, but CTO and co-founder. But
no, that's okay. I appreciate the promotion.
That's what happens with future-proofing now. But I've also included your LinkedIn impressions there. So as people see this both live and in its tape formats, hopefully you can go to Kay McGladney, Robert Gourley, and Carol Tang. Just a couple of housekeeping notes to close us out toward the end. We tend to promote our follow-up kind of webcasts. We've got our future-proofing awards. So we are in the business of identifying in 12 different categories, actually 13 different categories, companies, brands, organizations that we think are doing a really good job. So in 2 weeks' time, we'll be exposing those. We have a great e-newsletter that gets a lot of this information out and some of the webcasts called the FN Vault. We think it's perhaps the smartest newsletter on the web, but we could be wrong. Myself and Andrew are also getting a book out later this month. And you know, certainly cybersecurity, I guess, wades into some of it, but certainly risk management and kind of getting into a murky future is certainly one of the tenets of the book. And then finally, kind of an interesting one here. We've, over the last 3 months, built something called the Gray Swan Guild, where we've identified and handpicked 200 members around the world. We get together, we collaborate, and we're about to produce our first report this week called Emergent Perspectives in the Wake of a Pandemic. So we've spent a lot of time, effort, and energy on this, and so we're quite happy to be getting that out. If you're interested at all in that as listeners or panelists, hello@futureproofingnext.com can perhaps get you into our guild. And that's it for now, Andrew. Maybe some closing notes in terms of just our overall discussion today and where we are.
Closing notes, I really liked what Bob said, that, you know, despite the dark topic, we are all smiling. I like what Carol said about we are all learning. And I like what Kane said about we can understand the complexity, but act in the specificity. And I think that those are very compatible with the way that we work with clients and the way that we look at the world as future proofers. So no, I'm absolutely thrilled and really tremendous thanks and appreciation to the panel. This was one of the best conversations about a very, very important and timely topic. And that's it. So, Sean?
I can completely concur with you, Andrea. And so I'll just close this out. We're at the top of the hour now. So thank you, panelists. Thank you, Andrea. Thank you, listeners. And until we see you in the future.